So it's the second paragraph of the Hallel, and it's chapter 114 in Tehillim. So if you have a Tehillim, that's fantastic. You can open it up, and yeah, we'll start in now. Now it's 10 o'clock, okay. Well, good morning, everybody. Good to see you all, and yeah, so we'll start. You are all muted, but since I'm not sharing a screen, I can actually see you. So if you have a question, you can motion, I guess. But at the end, I'll definitely unmute everybody and you can ask any questions, and hopefully it'll be clear. So last week we explored generally what Hallel is and specifically this specific Hallel that we say on Yom Tov and on Rosh Chodesh, and we also read the first paragraph of the Hallel, and we analyzed it, and we saw some beautiful things. Now, obviously, whenever we learn, we know there's so much depth to everything. It can be learned and learned and learned and learned, but we're still going to move on. And we're going to go to the second chapter of the Hallel, which is, as we said, chapter 114 in Tehillim, Perek Kuf Yud Dalet in Tehillim. And this chapter is one of the reasons why the Hallel is called, as we mentioned last week, Hallel Mitzri. Hallel Mitzri meant a small Hallel, but it also means the Egyptian Hallel, because you'll see here, what do we mention immediately, is the miracle of the Jewish people leaving Egypt. And you can see that right away in the first pasuk. It says, "Bitzeis Yisrael Mimitzrayim," when the Jewish people, when Yisrael left Egypt, "Beis Yaakov Me'am Loyes," the house of Yaakov from an alien language. Me'am Loyes, literally, many of the commentaries translated as a foreign or a alien language. So we'll see what this means. What's the flow here? So we say that last week we mentioned how at the end, at the end of the 10 Makos, the 10 plagues, the last one, when Hashem was smiting all the firstborn, Paro himself was frightened. And not only was he frightened, but he at that point had no choice but to openly recognize that there's one controller, one God. And he urged Moshe and the Jewish people to sing praise to Hashem. And it wasn't just Paro, but it was all of the Egyptians. So at that point, we reach a level where almost the entire world is recognizing that there is one God who controls the world and who is taking specific interest in the Jewish people. And that's the flow of what we are continuing now. So now we discuss how the Jewish people, when they actually left Egypt, and where did they leave from? So it's very specific. It says, we left from Egypt. And where else did we leave from? We left from a place that we refer to, or a space that we refer to as a place of a foreign language. A foreign language, it's Me'am Loyes. So what does this mean? Very, very interesting. It says like this, you know, that the Jewish people, when they left, when they were taken out of Egypt by Hashem, it was a tremendous miracle, a tremendous kindness. In what merit did the Jewish people merit to be taken out of Egypt? So we are told, many midrashim tell us, obviously there were many, many merits, but three specific ones, as we know. The fact that they didn't change their names, they didn't change their clothing, and they didn't change their language. We see something interesting in this first pasuk. It says, "Bitzeis Yisrael." How did we refer to ourselves? We called ourselves Yisrael. We always identified ourselves by our Jewish name. And then, "Beis Yaakov, Me'am Loyes." Me'am Loyes, as we said, an alien language. We didn't, so to speak, adopt the Egyptian tongue. And in the next pasuk, it says, "Hoysa Yehuda l'kotshay," which means that Judah remained, so to speak, became holy. Holiness signifies the fact that we didn't change our clothing. We retained our holiness. But coming back to this pasuk, there's a few interesting things, because it says the name of the Jewish people here are referred to in two ways, one Yisrael and one Yaakov, and that's interesting, and we'll have to see why. The other thing is, before we go into that, I just want to understand, what is this Me'am Loyes? What is this, so to speak, foreign, alien language, so to speak? And also, even before we try to understand, what does it mean that the Jewish people didn't speak an alien tongue? So on a simple level, why it's Loyes is a foreign language is just because the word La'az can be a strange tongue, Or la'as can come from the language of mockery, because the Egyptians mocked us. And the truth is that despite our deceiving ourselves, wherever we live in the world, when we are amongst other nations, they do mock us. So why should we want to adopt their tongue when it's their tongue that they use to put us down? So we should have a Jewish way of talking, and that's all through the ages we've always had, whether it be Yiddish, whether it be Ladino, whatever it was, even the English that we speak is not always the same. We have what we call a Jewish tongue, and that's extremely important. But we find an interesting question. How is it possible to say that the Jewish people lived in Egypt for 210 years and they didn't know Egyptian? They didn't speak Egyptian? Does that make sense? So the commentaries have different versions of how they explain it. According to some, they say that the only people that learned to actually speak Egyptian were the ones that had to go out to work. But we know that there was always one tribe, the tribe of Levi, that remained at home, and they didn't ever learn Egyptian. And then there was a big section, the woman. And that's why it says Beis Yaakov. You know, in Torah, Beis Yaakov, just like before the giving of the Torah, that's why it's called Beis Yaakov. The schools are the schools for the girls. Beis Yaakov are referring specifically to the woman. The women were the ones who retained their holy tongue. And this was incredibly powerful and impacted on the entire nation. So we see another interesting thing. Another interesting thing it says is that even the Jews who did have to speak Egyptian because they went out to work and they mixed amongst the Egyptians, they didn't speak Egyptian when they came home. They only spoke it outside. But once they entered their home, that language remained outside. So that's a very powerful one. And another beautiful thing that the Medrash tells us, and it's actually explained very, very beautifully. It says, I just want to see the exact words here, sorry. That Moshe Rabbeinu, you know, it says that Moshe Rabbeinu had a impediment of the tongue. And especially when he was asked to go to speak to Parah, he refused and he said to Hashem, Kvad Peh, Kvad Lashon, you know that I can't speak. And some of the commentaries tell us something very beautiful. They say, the truth is that when it came to Lashon Kodesh, to the Holy Tongue, Moshe had no problem. What did Moshe have a problem with? Egyptian. Because he was such a holy person that Egyptian wouldn't even, and like he couldn't roll it off his tongue. His tongue stopped him from speaking that coarse and low language of such a coarse and low immoral people. So it's a very fascinating thing. So that's also why we say, Mei Am Layez, that we were taken out. We are a people who were taken out who did not engage in that foreign tongue. Now, we continue and we say, just want to make sure. Okay, yes, so just one thing also, this first two words is going to flow through, is going to be the theme of the entire chapter. Bitseis Yisrael Mimitzrayim, when the Jewish people left Egypt. The truth is, we didn't just leave, we were taken out of Egypt, miraculously. We were taken out of Egypt, not just miraculously, but in a certain sense, we almost couldn't extricate ourselves. We were like stuck almost, and Hashem had to yank us out. But why do we start the chapter with this? As we'll see, because this is the underlying theme, that we not only left Egypt thousands of years ago, but every single day and every single moment of the day, we are meant to be leaving our own Egypt. But something very important that we have to remember as soon as we start, so to speak, this praising, this Hallel, is the fact that we left Egypt, so we should never return to Egypt. We should never want to return. We have to make sure constantly that we are always leaving Egypt. And if we forget, if we put that in the back of our mind, unfortunately, we can revert back, at least spiritually, to being in Egypt. So that's a very important theme that we'll see that will run through, that we were taken out, we left, and we have to constantly be leaving and never, ever, ever want to or allow ourselves to return to that stage. And we know that Egypt, we've mentioned many, many times, Mitzrayim is a concept of limitation. It's a place of immorality. It's a place of lowness. It's a place of definition of borders, which means it's a place where a person feels that they don't feel Hashem. It's a place devoid of godliness. That's what it is. And we never want to find ourselves in that space. We're going to see as we run through, it'll come up again soon. Now let's continue and we describe how we left Egypt. So we say, Haisa, what happened to us? Haisa Yehuda Lekachai. So Yehuda became, so to speak, sanctified, became his holy nation. Just Yisrael Mam Shalaisav, Yisrael, his dominion. You know, so it became Hashem's nation. Again, we have a double, Yehuda and Yisrael. But something very fascinating, if you look into this pasuk, the first word is Haisa, which is in the feminine. Yehuda is not feminine. Yehuda is a man. Why does it say Haisa Yehuda? It should say Haya Yehuda Lekachai. So very interesting. Some of the commentaries explain in a few different ways. So one of the ways that it's explained is that Yehuda, at the time that the Jewish people left Egypt, and we're coming to the next part of the chapter, one of the next big miracles that happened was that they were standing before the sea. And we know that the Egyptians were behind them, the sea was in front of them, and the Jewish people were despairing, what will they do? And we all know the story, what happens. The first one to jump into the sea is Nachshon ben Aminadav from the tribe of Yehuda, right? The interesting thing that some people are unaware is that at that time there was actually a little bit of a scuffle, because it wasn't just Nachshon that wanted to jump into the sea, but the tribe of Binyamin. A few members of the tribe of Binyamin were trying very hard to edge themselves to be the first ones to jump into the sea. And it seems that there was this whole argument that took place, and Nachshon managed to prevail, and he jumped in first. Why? What was the argument even? What was Binyamin saying, and what was Yehuda saying? So the interesting thing is that we understand the idea of jumping into the sea is the idea that we believe firmly that if Hashem took us out of Egypt, he's going to get us to where we have to go. Nothing is going to stand in our way. Jumping into the sea on a normal day is suicide. I mean, that kind of a sea, right? So you can't do it. But what was Yehuda's claim? Yehuda said that I, as royalty, as the king priest, as the kingly tribe, which means that we are the leaders of the Jewish people, if we jump into the sea, all of the rest of the Jewish people will follow us in, because we are the leaders. And if all the Jewish people jump into the sea, Hashem will definitely split the sea for us. No question about it. So Yehuda said, if I jump in, it's not suicide. It's an act of, if you want to say, Mesiras Nefesh, bravery, but it's an act of trust in Hashem, which will engender others to follow. Binyamin said to Yehuda, that's all very fine and good, but I have something up on you. What do I have? It says that Hashem is, so to speak, taking us out of Egypt, and what are we becoming? We are becoming Bnei Yisrael, the children of who? Yisrael. And we know that Yaakov is referred to by two names. One is the name of Yaakov, which is, so to speak, the lower name, and Yisrael is the higher name. Yisrael stands for Li Reish, if you jumble the letters, which means I am in charge. Yisrael is the name that Yaakov was given when he was able to overcome his struggle with the angel. The only tribe that was born to Yaakov after his name was changed to Yisrael was the tribe of Binyamin. So Binyamin says, I am Bnei Yisrael. We are the ones that should be jumping into the sea, not you, Yehuda. But nevertheless, Yehuda did prevail, and he managed to get first, and Binyamin followed him. The idea being something also very incredibly prophetic, which is fascinating. It goes, this struggle doesn't just stop there. You know, on Matzah Shabbos, we're learning in the Navi the story of Shaul and David HaMelech. Who was the first king? Shaul. Which tribe is he from? The tribe of Binyamin. Where is David HaMelech from? He's from the tribe of Yehuda. And this struggle is a struggle which goes through the generations. It's a positive struggle. It's not that they want something negative. They want to come closer to Hashem and lift and elevate the Jewish people to closer to Hashem. But the fascinating thing is, who prevails at the end? We know, where does Mashiach come from? From David HaMelech. Ultimately, it is the tribe of Yehuda who is the one chosen to be royalty. How does that connect to the feminine? Because what is unique about the tribe of Yehuda? So you know, it says when Leah named Yehuda, what does Yehuda mean? Yehuda comes from the language of thanks and maida, which means to admit, to acknowledge, the concept of absolute total submission. I submit. Yehuda is totally submitted to Hashem. Yehuda puts himself aside, and what does he focus on? What Hashem wants. That's the true Jewish king, as we've often said. The true Jewish king is not a king who takes power to himself. Rather, he's the conduit of Hashem's power. He's the representation of Hashem's royalty. So just like in the feminine and the masculine, we always say the masculine is the giver, the feminine is the receiver. Yehuda displays the ultimate receiving. He says, I am nothing but a receiver from Hashem. I have nothing on my own. And that's why Yehuda is truly the model of what we follow. We follow this concept of realizing that there is absolutely nothing we can do on our own. It is only Hashem, so to speak, and Hashem who assists and works and is with us constantly. So that's why it's Haisa Yehuda, and that's what makes us truly a holy nation, a nation which is sanctified to Hashem. And that's why, and that's what about, just want to check one more thing, see what, because there was one more thing on this pasuk. Okay. That's right. I knew there was something else very beautiful. The Medrash says a beautiful thing also, that it's also connected. Actually, it's not the Medrash, the Maharal says. The Maharal of Prague says something beautiful. He says that, why also is it in the feminine? Because what did Yehuda accomplish here when he jumped into the sea? That enabled the Jewish people to jump into the sea. And then afterwards, what follows is they travel from the sea to Har Sinai and they receive the Torah. And we all know that the giving of the Torah is the time of the marriage between the Jewish people and Hashem. So we see here something very incredible. It is through Yehuda that we as a nation become Hashem's bride, the Kala. A Kala is feminine. Haisa Yehuda Likotshoi, from the language of Kiddushin, like a marriage. The marriage was accomplished through Yehuda. What is Yehuda? The Kala. Hashem the Chassin. That's why it is said in the feminine also. So a very beautiful idea, which again, this doesn't just mean Yehuda, this means all of us nowadays. And again, to remember every time we read this Perek in Tehillim, this is what we are meant to, so to speak, strive, if you want to say, to internalize. This idea of, and what the strong message here, is not only submission, but it's submission with love. That's the idea of the Kala and the Chassin. It's the relationship that we have Hashem, that we have with Hashem, that is one of a loving relationship. So that's something that we're meant to, if you want to say, be aware of as we're reading this pasuk. And the interesting thing is also that we say Yisrael Mam Shaloisa, that we become, so to speak, the dominion of Hashem, which is interesting because when did we become the dominion of Hashem? And dominion, in a sense, almost sounds like the concept of a memshala or a mashal is somebody who is a ruler. It's another form of a king. The Jewish people almost at this point, they always are, but this is when it becomes revealed and visible to everybody that the Jewish people are the true rulers over nature. They are the ones to whom nature bows. Yisrael Mam Shalaisav. And that will lead us into the next pasuk, what happens next? Just want to make sure we haven't missed anything important, and we'll go on to the next one. Okay. I'll just read you it's similar, but the words of Reb Shamshon Felhirsch, this is a translation, just very beautiful. He says, therefore the feminine form Haisa is employed here with reference to Yehuda, indicating that Yehuda had been divested of all arrogance and conceived of itself solely as dependent on God. And this is the key for the next step. And what's the next step? The next step is actually the splitting of the sea. So let's see the next pasuk. What's the next pasuk? This chapter is actually a very beautiful chapter in a sense. It's very, how do you say it? It has very beautiful imagery, if you want it. I don't like that word, but it's like a picture, you know, kind of a chapter where you can picture everything. So it's very, very flowery and poetic. And what is the next pasuk? The next pasuk tells us, Hayom ra'av vayonos, the sea saw and it fled. Vahayardein yisoiv l'achar, the Jordan turned around, turned its back, so to speak. So both whether they be, now we have to understand, what does this mean? Why are we saying Hayom and the Yarden? Which sea are we referring to? So of course, according to most of the Mefarshim, the sea that we're referring to is the Yam Suf, the one that they're coming to that's in front of them, the Egyptians behind them, and they have to somehow get across, right? Otherwise they're doomed. But some Mefarshim say that the Pasuk mentions the Yarden also, because a little bit less known is that there was another time that the sea didn't actually split but moved to the side, was when the Jewish people wanted to enter the land of Israel in time of Yehoshua, after Moshe Rabbeinu passes away, and at that point the Yarden actually moves to a side. So Hayam Ra'a Vayanos, the sea sees us and it runs, so it splits for us, and the Yarden also turns away when we have to go across to enter into the land of Israel. Some opinions say no, that this is actually only talking about when the Jewish people are leaving Egypt. This was authored, so to speak, in the time of Moshe Rabbeinu. This song was sang by the Jewish people as they were crossing, in a sense, the sea and coming close to Har Sinai. What does it mean? So we know the famous thing that at the time that the sea split, when the Jewish people went through, not only did the Yam Suf split, but all the waters in the world split at the time, right? It affected the entire world. So when we say Hayom Ra'a Vayanos, that the sea saw the Jewish people and it split, it caused that everywhere in the world, Hayarden, even the Yarden turned aside, meaning all the waters in the world were affected at the time. So it could be explained, so to speak, in both ways. But we have an interesting question. What made the sea split? Hayom Ra, it says the sea saw. So the big question that all the Mefarshim say is, what did the sea see to make it flee? You know, the way people put it. So what did the sea actually see? Because it says the sea saw, right? The sea saw something and it ran away. What did it see? So simply, it saw the Jewish people, right? That they're in strife and they're, or it saw Nachshon jumping in and it splits. But the Midrashim and all the commentaries tell us it's much, much deeper than that. The truth is, the sea didn't want to split. The sea from the 6 days of creation is made in a way which it's constantly flowing. Water doesn't naturally split. Not only doesn't it naturally split, but the way Hashem created the nature of water and the Yam and the oceans and the seas is that they should, you know, they should flow along. And when something is created by Hashem with a certain nature, especially not, I'm talking besides human beings who have free choice, putting us aside, the way they praise Hashem is by being consistent with the way they were created. So for the sea to split is going against its nature and perhaps going against, in a sense, the will of Hashem. What will cause the sea to all of a sudden do something which it's not naturally created to do? So there's different opinions. It has to be something big. So one opinion describes that Moshe Rabbeinu lifted his staff, and when the sea saw the mateh, the stick of Moshe, well, it got scared and it split. Obviously meaning a lot more than that. It means that it saw that Moshe Rabbeinu was working as an agent of Hashem, and therefore it said, oh, we have no choice, and we have to split. And the Medrash actually tells us that Moshe had to have a whole conversation, but the sea didn't want to split, but Moshe said, you know, this was a condition from Sheshes Yimei Bereshis, you know, that you're going to split when the Jews have to come. So the sea said, okay, I have no choice, I have to do it. There's another opinion that says it's not the stick of Moshe that caused the sea to split, but the stick of Moshe was actually lifted for the Jewish people's sake. And when the stick of Moshe was lifted, Hashem revealed himself. And when the sea saw Hashem, then it split. Okay, so that's one opinion. But another opinion, which is a very famous one, and I know we've mentioned this, but it's such a powerful concept, and this is also very much the underlying theme of this chapter, is what did the sea see? It saw the famous thing, and I'll read you in a few different ways, because there's different medrashim and different commentaries, and it's just so beautiful. So it saw the Arayin of Yosef. Literally, we might translate the casket of Yosef. As we mentioned last week, that Yosef was taken, we mentioned it actually in our Chumashir, that Yosef was taken out of Egypt, right? The bones of Yosef. He made the Jewish people promise that when they leave, they will take him so that they can bury him in the land of Israel. When the sea saw the casket of Yosef, all of a sudden it splits. Why? There's a whole nation of Jewish people alive, and that doesn't cause it to split. But all of a sudden, the casket of Yosef causes it to split. What is it about Yosef that has such an effect on the Yam Suf? So I just want to read you something quite beautiful because there's so many different ways. It says like this. It says, I'll read you one thing. So the Medrash tells us like this. What was it? So it's all like this. When we look at Yosef, what happened to Yosef? So Yosef, we know, when he was taken down to Egypt, just on a simple level, he was taken down as a 17-year-old boy, all by himself, separated from his family in a foreign place, in a foreign culture, totally the opposite of what he had been brought up. And we know that he didn't just travel on his own in a comfortable way. We know all the travails that he went through. He had been literally deceived and totally rejected by his own siblings, the ones who you would imagine would love him and protect him the most. Yosef comes down to Egypt, and we know what happens. He becomes a servant first in the house of Potiphar. He's amazingly successful, and he becomes in charge of the whole household. And we know the story, the famous story, that Yosef, as we mentioned a few times, Yosef was incredibly, incredibly, incredibly good-looking. He's one of the most good-looking people that ever lived. And the wife of Potiphar, on a simple level, this is, really, really wanted Yosef. And we know that she tried very, very hard to entice him, month after day after day after day after day, and Yosef constantly resisted. It took superhuman effort for Yosef alone, a 17-year-old boy in a foreign country, to resist his master's wife. And yet he did. Until the story came, as we know, to the climax. And what happens that day? Everybody's out of the house. She remains alone with Yosef. And as we know the story, she grabs his coat because she says, this is it. This time you're not getting away. And what happens? And the Pasuk tells us, she grabs him by his cloak, Lamar, Shikhva imi, right, be with me. So what does Yosef do? He leaves his cloak, biyada, in her hand, vayanas, and he runs, vayetze hachutza, and he goes outside. Yosef runs and goes outside. The same thing, look at the language, vayanas, he runs. So the Medrash tells us, Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Yonus Mipnei Hanos. You see, better run in front of the one who ran. Yosef, who had the strength, that incredible inner strength, to despite everything that was going wrong in his life, to still retain that sense of holiness, that sense of connection to his father's household, to what he was raised with, and he ran. You see, you better run. You have to run in front from this person, so to speak, from this greatness. It's interesting. So the different languages, Hayam Loi Nikra, the sea didn't split, Ella Bischusay Shal Yosef, only in the merit of Yosef. And it says Vayikach Moshe, and other languages that are used is not the casket, the Arayin, but some use even an interesting language. It says Vayikach Moshe es Atzamos Shal Yosef. It's actually quite a graphic language. It was the bones of Yosef, which is interesting because it doesn't sound so respectful to use that language, the bones of Yosef. It should have just said, I mean, we know he's in the casket, right? Yosef himself. But why? Because we can use that word and we can say not atzamos, bones, but atzmos, the essence of Yosef. What did the sea see? They saw the essence of Yosef. What was the essence of Yosef? So just to understand, take a little step back also, what happened at the sea? So one of the ways, there's many ways to explain it, but one of the, like I say, one of the very beautiful ways is that why was the sea being so resistant to splitting all of a sudden? I mean, the Jewish people had to leave. The Egyptians are behind them, right? Doesn't the sea want to assist the Jewish people to be saved? What's stopping them? So very interesting. We know the famous Medrash tells us that when the Jewish people camped by the Yam Suf, all of a sudden something happened. They started to argue and they started to become factionalized, right? And there were four different opinions. Should we go back to Egypt? Should we commit suicide? Should we daven? All the different ways. And nobody could agree with each other. up until that point, they were united. Now they're starting to get a little bit not so united. Now the sea sees this, and the sea feels, I don't know. And it's not obviously the sea itself. It's the Satan, you know? It's the Malach, the angel up there. And he's making a lot of trouble. And he says, I don't know if this nation is so worthy of these tremendous miracles. If they are a nation which acts as one nation, perhaps in the merit of them being one united nation, then we need to have the sea split. But if they're a factionalized nation, and we know they weren't very different than the Egyptians, that's the famous thing. We say they had sunk to a very low moral level. So then the Sultan has somehow a little bit of a claim and says, I don't know about this. Maybe this nation doesn't deserve to be made miracles for. So what do the bones of Yosef show? So there's a magnificent, beautiful medrash that tells us something interesting. It says that Yosef's bones, or if you want to say Yosef himself, the essence of Yosef, was the biggest ammunition, the biggest claim against this claim. What was it? So he says that it's very interesting. The medrash tells us that the entire time that Yosef found himself in Egypt, he didn't drink wine. You know, we see that in the story even, that when he was giving his brothers, he himself didn't drink. Why didn't he drink? So it says because he was mourning for his fathers and for his brothers, right? The Medrash says, "Miyom Shapirish Yosef Me'echav," from the day that he became separated, "Loi Tam Tam Yayin." He didn't taste the taste of wine. Why not? The Ben Ish Chai says, why not? Why didn't he taste wine? He maybe ate other things. Why not wine? So the Ben Ish Chai says, what was Yosef doing? And this is unbelievable. He says he was constantly engaged in davening for his brothers that they shouldn't be harmed because of what they did to him. So they had hurt him in the worst possible way. The worst possible way that you would never expect from a sibling. They did the worst thing possible. And yet, Yosef davens every single day to Hashem, don't harm them. What does that have to do with wine? So the Ben Ish Chai says, when we are drunk, we can't daven. You have to be sober to daven. Yosef wanted to make sure he was always able to daven, so that the Satan shouldn't have a moment to come in and start to say, oh, these people, look what they've done. So what does that show us? Something beyond incredible. What does Yosef, in a sense, stand for? Yosef stands for not just ordinary unity, if you want to say. Yosef stands for something which is almost, it is superhuman. It's not, it really is. It's that ability which is to take this incredible challenge, but specifically this, if you want to say, it's not, I don't know what the word is, it's jealousy and it's hatred and it's all these terrible things that he was shown. And not only doesn't he learn from them to act that way, not only doesn't he model himself on them, but rather he acts in the exact total opposite way, which is absolutely superhuman. It's as superhuman as splitting of the sea. Just like the sea naturally flows, now we're asking it to split. What Yosef was doing was something way beyond. But we might say, oh, that's great. So that means that that's not expected from us because it's superhuman. And look, it's like the splitting of the sea. But what do we know? And this is something quite incredible. You know, we've taught many times that we are B'nai Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah, right? Why are we called their children? Because just like a parent gives the child, you know, the DNA, so to speak, so we inherit all the traits of our parents. And we usually explain that the Shvatim, we don't necessarily have all of their traits because we don't come from all of them, right? We only come from one Shevet. We might not even be aware of which Shevet we come from. But Yosef is different. You know, it says in Tehillim, there's a very beautiful pasuk that tells us about Yosef, that Yosef was the one who supplied us with our food. And therefore it says that Yosef became, it says, Ga'alta, that we were redeemed, Bizraya Amecha, right, with the mighty arm, you redeemed your nation. And who is the nation? B'nei Yaakov, V'Yosef Sela. We are called the children of Yaakov and the children of Yosef. All of us, even if we don't come from his shevet. What does that mean? That after Yosef worked on himself to achieve this level of, I don't know, you know what you want to call it, this incredible, incredible high level of being able to return good for bad, so to speak. But it's even deeper than that. To look way beyond what the brothers were doing to him. and to see the essence, to see the godliness, and to see the greater mission, and to see the greater journey. Because as we've often explained, if not for Yosef, we wouldn't be here. Yosef did that, and he gave us all the ability. We believe, and that's what we say when we say this Hallel. We say that we can do this. We have the ability to, within ourselves, literally split the sea, go against our natural tendencies. And this is a very powerful thing, and that's why it says, that's what the sea saw. It saw Yosef going against his natural tendency, had no choice, I have to go against my nature. Okay, it's just, there are many, many beautiful ways to explain it, but I think that we were gonna leave that for now. Just one more thing, just to show, you know, as we're just a drop more to elaborate. Because when, and we're going to, maybe, hopefully, I don't know if we'll have time, actually, but maybe we'll mention a little bit more. Because when we're talking about the sea splitting, you know, the concept of the sea splitting is also quite a powerful thing, even Kabbalistically, if you want to say. What does it represent? Not just Kabbalistically, but even for us, if you want to say, in a spiritual sense. The sea is usually covered, right? Everything that's in the sea, you know, we say that everything that's on dry land has a counterpart in the sea. It's interesting. And they do. If you study, I don't know what it's called, the science of studying, but the ones who study the under the ocean, all the marine biologists, they can tell you that every animal on dry land has a counterpart under the sea. And the Chachamim tell us that that's true. And Kabbalistically, the sea is referred to as what we call Alma d'Iskasya, the covered, the hidden realm. Whereas we are on dry land, which is called Alma d'Iskalya, the revealed world. Interestingly enough, the higher place is Alma d'Iskasya. What does that mean? Usually we think of hidden as, oh, that's a place, you know, hidden is not a good thing. But the truth is that what does hidden represent here? It represents the fact that the items or the things that are alive within the sea do not feel themselves to be independent beings. They know that how are they alive? Only by the water. And if they go out of the water, they're going to die. We on dry land deceive ourselves, right? Because we can move around and we don't realize, we're not aware that if oxygen stops for a moment, that we won't live. We're not aware of that. We're not conscious of that. But the items which are in the sea are very conscious of the fact that they need the water to survive. That means that Alma d'Iskasya in this context refers to a place where really godliness is revealed. What is hidden is everything which is not godliness. So when we're talking about the sea splitting, what's happening there? Something incredible. Usually, God is hidden. That's how Hashem created the world. Because if he wasn't, we wouldn't stay alive, right? As we know, in a physical sense, we would all become nullified to godliness. We would just all become, in a way, almost robots and puppets, in a sense, and just doing the will of Hashem. There would be no free choice, right? So Hashem creates the world where we deceive ourselves and we think we're independent beings. But at the time of Kriyas Yamsuf, what became the true reality for every single Jew? That Hashem is the true reality. And we, I'm not sure if we exist or not, you know, we're just subservient, we're just here because Hashem is creating us. That's what happened at Kriyas Yamsuf. Coming back to Yosef, this is what Yosef stands for. Yosef stands for that ability to have God as the real reality. Not another human being that might think he's a master over us, and not us giving another human being that incredible importance by saying, which sometimes we don't translate it this way, but by saying, he has the power to hurt us, therefore I will bear a grudge. No, he has no power over us. The only one is Hashem. Therefore, what becomes the reality? The reality is Hashem. Nothing else is as real as Hashem's existence. And this is Yosef. This is Yosef was walking, talking that in his whole life. And that's why we know that wherever Yosef found himself, whether it be in the dungeon, in Potiphar's house, in Pare's house, whether it be in the pit with the snakes and the scorpions, whatever it was, Yosef never ever forgot that. To him, it was Hashem that was the reality. Again, that's what we meant to contemplate when we read this pasuk. That's what the sea sees, which means we are able to do that. Okay, so moving on from there, because the chapter does continue, and it tells us like this, that Hayar, so all of this, as we know, is a preparation for the receiving of the Torah, that we reveal that inner strength, if you want to say, and that connection to Hashem. I don't know if I should. Okay, I'll just drop one small beautiful thing, just one. Sorry, just one last thing. It's not specifically Yosef, but we just said that this is the idea of the unity. That's what Yosef brings out, the idea of the fact that he's able to forgive. He has that capacity to forgive, despite the fact that perhaps, you know, not only perhaps, but he was extremely hurt and things, injustices were done to him. When do we say Hallel? So one of the main times that we say Hallel, as we know when we're coming up, is Yom Tov. Shavuos is going to be one of the days. We're going to say Hallel on Shavuos on a Yom Tov. And we know that one of the beautiful things about Yom Tov, and it's an interesting thing halachically, is that Yom Tov is a time that we are actually halachically meant to enjoy a good Yom Tov meal, right? Everybody knows that Yom Tov is a time, you know, people set aside and get the choicest piece of meat. I don't know if you ask the butcher, I think they say that all the brisket is gone before Yom Tov, right? Everybody makes the best roast, whatever. So the interesting thing is that halachically speaking, it does have room that we should actually make a good Yom Tov meal, and a person is meant to enjoy with good wine, with good meat and everything. But I just want to read you one beautiful thing from the Rambam, because I think this is just, it's just practical and so, so beautiful. And the Rambam in Hilchas Yom Tov mentions that he tells, you know, that we sit and we enjoy our meals and we have all the nice delicacies. And then he says like this, he says, Ein simcha elo b'basa, right? There's no joy only with meat and ein simcha elo b'yayin. And then he says, u'kishu oichel v'shoyseh. When you are sitting and eating and drinking and enjoying your Yom Tov meal, chayav lahachil leger v'layasayim v'la'almana im shar ha'aniyim ha'umdalim. You must not forget that who must you include in your Yom Tov table? You have to include the convert and the orphan and the widow and the poor nebach, anybody who's alone, anybody who's lonely, anybody who doesn't have. He says, aval, misha noyel dlosses chetzer, somebody who locks the doors of their courtyards, v'oichel v'shoyse, hu banav ishtay, and he just sits with his own family, him and his wife, whatever, just on their own, v'einay maichel umashkel aniyim, and doesn't give the poor to eat and drink, ulemeri nefesh, and to those who are bitter of soul, ein zu simchas mitzvah, this is not called a joy of mitzvah. He actually has a very strong language, Ela simchas kresai. This is called a joy of the belly. This is the lowest form of joy. This is an animalistic joy. What is the Rambam telling us? And this is connected to the Hallel, as we say. What must we remember? We must remember that on Yom Tov is a time to be filled with joy. But what is joy? Joy is that ability to be with others. Others not just physically. We mean sometimes we can't be with others physically, but even emotionally and spiritually. We have to be able to open ourselves up to include others. It shouldn't be about ourselves and our own pleasure and our own, you know, so to speak, self-growth. Just it's about others, even more importantly about others, which means that capacity, as Yosef had, to see other before himself. That's an incredible capacity that we learn from Yosef, part of the Hallel thing. Okay, so we move on and it says what happened. So the sea saw and it split, and then we say Hayardein, as we said, it turned backwards. The Jordan River, you know, it turned backwards during perhaps the time of Yehoshua. Then we continue and we say like this. So in Pasuk Hey, Heharim Rakdu Chaelim, so the mountains skipped like rams, Gvais Kivnei Tzayin, the hills like young sheep. It's very, very beautiful language, but what does this mean? So some of the Mefarshim say, when did the mountains skip like rams? So this could be at the time of the giving of the Torah, when the Jewish people come to Har Sinai, and Hashem is revealing himself on Har Sinai. Not only did Har Sinai start to tremble, but all the mountains that were around also trembled. And the Gvais are the lower mountains, the hills. So since they are smaller, they tremble like young sheep. And interesting also, we see that the sea runs, the mountains, what do? It's a skip, which means they ruktu is also like merake, they dance. So the sea runs and the mountains dance. So also very beautifully, the idea is that there's two expressions here of the revelation of God, of two reactions to the revelation of godliness. So on the one hand, there's a reaction of awe, and that's running. That's the fear of Hashem. And the sea runs, but the mountains, they are filled with love of Hashem. What do? they dance, which obviously signifies how we relate. So during a yontif or a Rosh Chodesh, and when we have an extra time of sort of, or a miracle that happens, and we have a sense of Hashem in a stronger way, what do? We have both the awe and the love. We run and we dance, and we can do them both at the same time. Okay, so all this is happening naturally. The whole world is shaking. This actually ties back to when the Jewish people left Egypt, because it says when the Jewish people left Egypt, the entire world was aware of the great, tremendous miracles. And now we come to the next pasuk, which is interesting, and to put it in context. So the next pasuk says, Malacha hayom kisonus. But what's with you, sea, that you are running, and Yarden Tisav la'achar, and the Jordan that you turn backwards? It's like we're asking the sea. We have to ask, who's asking? And it continues, Heharim tirkuducha elim. Why are you mountains skipping like rams, and gvois kibnei tzayin, and the, you know, all of the small hills like little sheep? Who's talking? Who's asking? So there's different opinions as far as who's asking. Either the whole world is asking, because as we say, the whole world feels this revelation, and the whole world notices that everything is different. The seas are splitting and the mountains are shaking. So they all notice this incredible, tremendous impact on nature. So everybody's wondering, what's happening? What's going on here? Because they're not the Jewish people. They might not be aware of God yet. We'll see in a minute. Or it could be something else. It's very, very interesting. The Medrash tells us that Moshe Rabbeinu had a conversation. That's what it says. So Moshe Rabbeinu says first to the sea. That's the Medrash describes. Obviously, he's not talking to the sea. Like this, I think there was a, whatever. Moshe, we don't have time for a joke. Moshe was talking, he wasn't actually talking to the sea, talking to, let's say, the Malach, which represents the sea. And he asks and he says, why are you fleeing? So the sea says, ask the mountains. So then he asks the mountains. The mountains say, ask the hills. Then the hills say, ask the earth, right? So he asks each one. And then the response comes in the next pasuk. And that's where we have the next pasuk. The response to why everything is happening. Why does the whole world seem like it's shaking and everything is trembling and everything is changing? Milifnei adayin chuli aretz. The earth says, I tremble before the master, the one who is the master of the whole world. And what? Who is he the master of? Milifnei Elokai Yaakov, specifically the God of Yaakov. So that's one way of explaining it, as we say that it's trembling in front of God, or we can say Milifnei Adayin Chuli Aretz, it is trembling because of the one who formed the land. Who is the formation of the land? Hashem formed the land, right? And Hashem, who formed the land originally to operate in a certain way, now is making everything operate in a totally different way. Because the same God that created the world in one way can create the world in another way anytime he wishes, so to speak. He is in control. And what the sea and the mountains and everything are responding to Moshe is, we are just simple creations of Hashem. We follow our master. And that's what they're telling Moshe. The idea being, again, it's really bringing home to us. We have all left Egypt. All of us, each and every one of us. Every day we are given the opportunity to leave Egypt. What does that mean? What does leaving Egypt mean? It means that we can, even if we naturally flow, we can split. If we're mountains, and what does mountains show? Mountains usually, if you know, we say majestic mountains, but mountains are very firm and stuck in their place. Water flows. Mountains remain stuck. So whether we be born with the nature that we're flowing, or we're stuck, rigid, maybe perhaps even in a good way, perhaps we're quite organized, and then some people are more like go with the flow kind of people, whatever nature you were born with, the tilim, this is what we say right away, you leave Egypt. You're not bound by your nature. You're not just defined as an ocean, and you're not defined just as a mountain. You're defined as Bnei Yisrael, as Yaakov, as servants of Hashem who are taken out of your usual limitations. Is a very powerful thing. And that's what it's telling us. Mipnei Adayin Chuli Aretz. It trembles before the one who created and forms the world. And we see a very interesting thing, that what's happening here is interesting. It's not just that they're going beyond their nature, Everything is being asked to do the opposite of its nature. So the sea, which usually stands still, is asked to split. The mountains, which are so firm, but okay, so it does jump, it's true, but they usually stay still, right? So the sea has to split, which means the sea has to stop moving. The mountains, which usually are not moving, now are dancing. So everything is being asked to go in exactly the opposite of its nature. And that's a real challenge for us many, many times. Because the truth is, abstract, it all sounds wonderful. And when we're singing it in Tehillim and in Shul, it's beautiful and wonderful. But practically speaking, in our day-to-day life, it's not so simple. I mean, we do have natures, and we do have circumstances, and life brings challenges, and we do feel compelled many times to act in a certain way, and we do feel limited by certain things. And this is an incredibly difficult, if you want to say, journey. But the point, as we said right away, to remember is that it's not just about us. On our own, you're right, impossible, actually. It's impossible. A mountain doesn't jump and a sea doesn't stop flowing. It doesn't. But with Hashem, it does. And that's what we have to always remember. As we said, we have to split our sea and reveal the neshama, which is usually hidden. When we reveal that, we realize that we can do it. But one thing very important to remember, just on a practical note, here it's massive, you know, the sea is splitting and everybody, the whole world notices, the mountains are jumping and the whole world hears and everybody is trembling and it's all wonderful, all the sound effects and all of this. In our life, a lot of times the splitting of the sea, maybe nobody else will even notice. The splitting of our individual sea can seem to somebody else like nothing, like ordinary, but for us, it's a splitting of the sea. So don't underestimate our challenges, but what we must, yes, do is realize that we can do it. So even if it's small, so to speak, on a certain, like by certain definitions, it might be considered small, for us it's massive, and it is a splitting of the sea. And this can happen every single day. This is not just a one-off, as we say. Every day Hashem takes us out of Egypt. So we continue and we say, as we said, that's what the answer to Moshe Rabbeinu says, because it's not from you. Actually, interesting, the Medrash says, you know, Moshe, it's not because we're not afraid of you. That's not why we split. That's not why we're jumping. It's not Moshe ben Amram. It's Mipnei Adoin Chuli Aretz, the master of the world. In other words, Hashem himself. So we have to realize that Hashem is, so to speak, within us, as we know we have a neshama. Hashem walks with us, and Hashem enables and gives us the strength to overcome these seeming insurmountable challenges. And I just want to read you just the beautiful words of the Malbim before we almost finished our time. He says, "Mipnei sha'adayin ba'atzmai," because the Master himself, Yarad b'chvaydai, comes down with his own, in his glory, so to speak, in his honor, lahashkiach, to actually supervise, v'lochein, and therefore chuli aretz, that's why the earth is trembling, u'ma haya hasiba shenizgala ha'adayin hazeh, and why does Hashem reveal himself? What causes Hashem to reveal himself? So that's why we say, mepnei shehu, Elekei Yaakov, because he's the God of Yaakov. Shemevi she mevuar etzli, shekol mokim shenemer Elekei Yaakov. Every place that it says uses this language of Elekei Yaakov, Elekei Yisrael. What does it show us? Moira, it reflects al hakesher, on the connection, the hakroiva, and the warm, close bond, sheyesh loy im am Yisrael, that Hashem has with his nation. What causes Hashem to reveal himself is because he loves us. He truly loves us. And he loves each and every one of us, as we say, as individuals. And because he reveals himself, the sea does split and the mountains do jump and they do leap and they do dance. That's what we say. And we say, like, this interesting, Nefnei Elekat, Yaakov, okay, so also very beautifully, Chaim Vital explains that Yaakov, when he crossed the Yarden, because we mentioned also the crossing of the Yarden, the first one to cross the Yarden was actually Yaakov. And when he was running away from Esav, right? So it says, Ki bimakli avarti es ha-Yarden. How did he cross the Yarden at that time? Hey, Nebach, he was running from Esav on his own with nothing. Makli, with my stick, which means literally with nothing. I had absolutely no financial help, no emotional support, no human interaction, nothing. I had to run by myself to a foreign land. And the word Bimakli is actually the same gematria as Yaakov. Yaakov represents that ability that we all have, even when we are on our own. And our own doesn't just mean physically. When we feel that we're on our own, we feel other people can't understand us, we're going through a challenge that other people don't have. Nevertheless, the Yom Yivaka, the Yaakov, can also be jumbled. If you scramble the letters of Yaakov, it can make the Hebrew word Yibaka. Yibaka means to split. For Yaakov, the sea splits. Who is Yaakov? Yaakov is a person who recognizes that he only has his stick. Who is he? He is somebody who is totally, as we said, submitted and recognizes that his whole existence and his whole ability to exist is because Hashem is with him. Hashem guides him. And that's why we finish and we say, Ha-hayfchi atzur agamayim, right? Who turns the rock into a pond of water, as the pasuk finishes. Sorry, just the last pasuk to turn my page. I don't know where my actual words are, he says. Sorry, see if I can find it here. Yeah. Ha-yifchi atzur agamayim, chalom eshlomayim amayim, right? Who turns the rock into a pond of water, the flint into a flowing fountain. So I know time is almost up. So just very, very quickly, again, we see the same thing. When Moshe Rabbeinu, this was in a positive sense, at the beginning when the Jewish people didn't have water, what does Hashem do? He tells Moshe to hit the rock. That's the time when he told him to actually hit it. And what comes out of the rock? Water. Again, a rock is a solid thing. And what does Hashem do? He takes something which is solid and he turns it into a source of liquid. Exactly the opposite of what should come out of a rock comes out of a rock. Water, again, showing us. It doesn't matter if we feel ourselves to be a rock. Hashem has the ability to, so to speak, make opposites happen, if you want to say, contradictory things, things which are insurmountable, almost impossible. And not only that, but Chalomish is a flintstone. A flintstone is usually used to make fire. You rub those two stones together and out comes fire. What happened with this flintstone? Water came forth. The opposite of fire. Fascinating. Again, the same thing. Hashem has the ability to take something which naturally looks like it should do this, and it can do something totally different. It's interesting because if you look at the last letters of the word, of the words, ha-hayfchi hatsur agambayim, so if you have to jumble them, but it's yud and resh and mem, make the name Miriam. Who, in whose merit did we have water as we were traveling through the desert? In the merit of Miriam, Moshe Rabbeinu's sister, that the Chassam Sofer says, Ha-hayfchi hatsur agamayim. I know there was a few other beautiful things, but time is really, really up. So I think we'll just conclude there. But just to remember, as we say, that mayim symbolizes chesed, kindness, and esh symbolizes gevura, which is exactly the opposite, you know, severity. And it's chesed and gevura, but both of them serve God. We use both attributes. And whether we be more dominantly a kind person or more dominantly a severe person, doesn't matter. We are not bound by either one. We have the ability to find within ourselves literally incredible resources, if you want to say. Within a rock, we can find water. So this is something, as we said before, the whole theme is that Hashem is constantly taking us out of Egypt. Sorry, one quick last thing, a very beautiful thing, that again, this is a Kabbalistic thing, but this is a beautiful gematria. It says that the name of Hashem, which actually in Kabbalah, which is referred to as the name of kindness, is a name which is of Ayin Beis, 72 letters. That's Ayin Beis. It's how you put together the name of Yudkei Vavkei to make that number, and that signifies Chesed, kindness. The name which signifies Gevura is Mem Beis, 42. 72 plus 42 equals 114. Which chapter in Tehillim is this? 114. It's the chapter 114, which tells us that we have the ability to combine Eish and Mayim, Chesed and Gevura. We are Bitzeis Yisrael Mimitzrayim. We are constantly being taken out of our Egypt, our limitations. This is chapter 114, a magnificent chapter. So let's hope we can internalize this message. And in Mirtz Hashem, I hope I could just try and remember myself on Shavuos when I'm saying Hallel or before on Rosh Chodesh, some of these beautiful lessons. They are so powerful. So have a very, very good day, a very good week. I'll unmute you if you have any questions. Sorry, to see if I can do this. Yeah. Okay. Everybody's unmuted. Any questions? Sorry, any questions? I can't hear. Okay, you. Everybody's unmuted, just to know. Okay, so any? No? Okay, bye, Dina. All right, well, have a wonderful day and a, yes, and a good night. Okay. Okay, see you. See you all. Okay, bye. 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 See you.
Thank you very much.
Okay.